All content published by Your Brain on Science is solely the opinions of the authors and does not reflect the opinions of any parties affiliated with them or any additional third parties.
Welcome to another episode of Your Brain on Science. It's me, Elena, and today we're going to talk about different types of experiences on psychedelics and whether these experiences can be truly deemed negative or positive. And to get at this, we have Abigail Calder, neuroscience PhD candidate at the University of Freiburg, and she's here to discuss her ongoing research. So welcome, Abigail.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And just a note, we both used to write for Psychedelic Science Review, right? I think that's where I first saw your name. And so that's pretty cool that we actually get to talk now, because I don't think we ever did before.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I totally slipped my mind. But yeah, so I've actually met a lot of awesome scientists is through the writing for PSR. And, you know, unfortunately, it kind of stopped publishing.
Yeah, it did.
But there's still a lot of great work on their website, so please check out Abigail's pieces as well as mine if you're interested. So can you tell us just like a little bit about yourself and what brought you into researching psychedelics and writing for PSR, for example?
Yeah, honestly, it's a little fuzzy. I think I was just about in the right place at the right time about 5 or 6-ish years ago. So just a little bit of background about me. I was born in the United States, but I've lived in Europe my whole life, whole adult life. And I did my studies in Germany. So I was in Germany in the middle of a neuroscience master's degree. And I was kind of wondering what I wanted to study, because I've always liked science. I've always wanted to stay in research, but I wasn't really sure what to research. And I was surrounded by a bunch of stressed out PhD students and thinking, you know, if I'm going to do this to myself, it better be for a good enough reason. So I need a topic that's really, really interesting to me. And somehow, I don't even remember exactly how, but I somehow stumbled upon the Johns Hopkins research with psilocybin. I think it was around the time How to Change Your Mind came out, which is a pretty typical story these days of how you got an interest in psychedelics. But I'd heard about them before through the meditation communities. And I think so they were a little bit on my radar just because I'd been into meditation for a couple of years and kept hearing and reading that people felt like psychedelics deepened their meditation practice. And I think it sounded kind of nuts to me at the time. But then I came across this research from Johns Hopkins and saw that people were actually studying psychedelics and that it was a legitimate field of scientific inquiry. And then I read How to Change Your Mind. And I remember feeling like as soon as I finished it, I was like, wait, that's it? Isn't there more? And I just decided, you know what, I want to go make some more research if it's not enough for me.
That's awesome. I really like that, the it's not enough thing, right? Because the psychedelic science is still so young in the modern age with all like the regulations and everything. So it's exciting to be a part of it now and like have that drive you to like.
Yeah. And I think that was a big draw for me at the time too. I'd considered maybe going into aging research or one of these other big fields that a lot of people are into, but I kind of felt like I would never make a difference there. They absolutely do not need me at all. And neither does psychedelics, I guess, but there's a bigger chance to make a difference, I think, if you get into something on the ground floor. So I think that was pretty exciting.
Yeah, that's awesome. So you're involved in a variety of studies at your university, so I read. So I wanted to talk a little bit about your ongoing work with you and maybe touch a little bit on plasticity before we get into talking more about those acute and long-term effects of psychedelics, because I think it kind of all wraps together, you know?
Yeah. The main quest of my PhD is about the effects of LSD on neuroplasticity. I've been doing my PhD at the University of Fribourg in Switzerland for about 2.5 years. And my main project involves giving people 100 micrograms of LSD and then trying to measure the effects on neuroplasticity. And we do research with healthy people. There's actually a lot of research in Switzerland with psychedelics and healthy people, I think more than anywhere else. So that's a pretty cool side note. And so basically we're trying to translate some of these animal findings on neuroplasticity into humans using relatively new methods that not many people have combined with psychedelics before. The way a lot of people try to measure neuroplasticity in humans is with BDNF in the blood. BDNF is brain-derived neurotrophic factor, and it supports neuroplasticity in the brain. And people have been trying to measure it in the blood in human studies, and the results are all over the place. It's just not that reliable. Even the people who work with it don't even like it anymore, to be honest. So we tried to apply some different methods to measure neuroplasticity, which are based on brain stimulation. I don't want to get too much into details, but one involves what we call tetanic stimulation, or extremely rapid sensory stimulation. And the other one involves transcranial magnetic stimulation. So that's a lot of stimulation going on. And we do this 8 hours after dosing people with LSD, and 1 day after and 7 days after, to try and see how long any effects on neuroplasticity might last.
Cool. So you don't do it at like the peak effect of the LSD, kind of wait
a little. I think that would be a little, first of all, unnecessary, because what we care about are these long-term effects. You know, if neuroplasticity is enhanced for 2 hours on the peak and then a day later it's already gone, it's not so clear what exactly the benefit would be. And also that would be extremely annoying for everyone involved. I don't want to do it. They don't want to do it. We just do it after they've already mostly calmed down.
Yeah, I couldn't imagine getting hooked out to some stimulation in my head, like peak LSD. That would be crazy.
Yeah, it's an EEG. So the main outcome is measured with EEG, electroencephalography. Maybe just for the listeners, that's these electrodes that we put on people's head to measure their brain activity. It's actually pretty tolerable for them. And people do some crazy stuff in studies with people on psychedelics that I'm glad I'm not doing. Like, they put people in MRIs and all MEGs and all sorts of things. They've got blood catheters going. We have the luxury in our study that people just get to have their trip for about 5 hours before we do anything to them. But yeah, that's what we do.
It's super interesting. So can you talk a little bit more just about plasticity in general, and kind of like what it means in the context of psychedelics? Like, what are the end goals? What do we want to see with psychedelics and plasticity? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the trajectory of research is with psychedelics and neuroplasticity is kind of starting in humans and then going to animal research and now trying to go back to humans again. So neuroplasticity, in case anybody doesn't know, is basically the brain's ability to rewire itself, to restructure itself, mainly in response to experiences. So a classic example is, if you learn to play the piano, then the parts of your brain that are responsible for moving your fingers in a particular way will grow. So we all have neuroplasticity. Neuroplasticity is what we use to learn. It's what we use to heal from brain injury. Kids have a lot of it, which is how they learn so many things so fast. Us adults are a little bit slower, but we still have neuroplasticity. And one thing about neuroplasticity is that it appears to be reduced in some psychological disorders, particularly depression. And I think with psychedelics, what came first was these findings in depression, especially with ketamine, but then later also with psilocybin and LSD, where people found that after a ketamine trip or a psilocybin trip, that people improved depression. People's depression improved, and they were trying to figure out why. And then back in, I think 2018 was a really big year for psychedelics and neuroplasticity, where there was this, you know exactly which paper I'm talking about. they were trying to test the theory that part of the reason for these improvements in depression was that psychedelics enhance neuroplasticity. So basically what that means is that they help neurons grow more connections with other neurons. And maybe that is something like saying it makes the person more adaptable and more able to update their beliefs about the world or respond to therapy, which is a little bit speculative, but that's sort of the idea. And so they found, I think it was Calvin Lai in the Olson lab in 2018, they found that in rats, both living rats and rat neurons in a dish, that various psychedelics basically made neurons grow. They enhanced neuroplasticity. That meant that neurons that were already existing grew new dendrites and synapses. A few labs have also suggested that psychedelics can enhance neurogenesis, which is the growth of new neurons, although the evidence for that is a bit weaker, but it might happen. We still have to see. But mainly what you see a lot of in these animal studies is that pretty much every time they look for it, scientists find that psychedelics enhance neuroplasticity in the cortex. So it particularly in the cortex, neurons exposed to psychedelics grow more branches and more connections with each other. And so that happens in animals. Mm-hmm. And of course, we want to know, does it also happen in humans? And the problem is, you'll know this very well, Elena, if you work with animals, is that we can't exactly mimic the methods in humans, because in order to measure enhanced neuroplasticity in animals, they took the brain out of the skull. We cannot do that. And so we have to kind of measure it in a more indirect way. And one relatively easy way is to try and find a marker in the blood, like BDNF, which I talked about earlier, that reflects neuroplasticity. But there's a lot of problems with that. And so what we're trying to do in our lab is measure it in a different way that's a bit closer to the brain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you mentioned that study in 2018, which is funny because in 2018, I was finishing my neuroscience bachelor's degree and my senior project was looking at dendritic growth with different ketamine concentrations and ketamine metabolite concentrations. So that paper came out. I'm like sitting in lab, like doing this, like on the microscope, and I'm just like, oh my God, it's real. someone else can replicate what I'm doing. But our work never got published, unfortunately. But then it was funny.
Did you actually find anything?
Yeah, like, I mean, I have photos still of like the microscope. Yeah. It was like some of the more like beginning just concentration curves and, you know, kind of getting the methods to work. But yeah, I have this one picture on my phone still that it was two neurons, two synapses coming together, and it was a heart.
Aww.
It was literally the cutest thing I've ever
seen. Now you just got to replicate that with MDMA and you're famous.
Yeah, exactly. But no, that paper was super cool. And then when I came to VCU in 2019, I really wanted to do cell cultures and look at BDNF and all the stuff in the neurons. And I couldn't get the cell culture to work in the new lab. So here I am now just doing behavior and some other circuitry related stuff. But side note, the interesting thing too, in what you mentioned, is that the translationality, right, of these studies, you mentioned, you know, you can't just take out a human brain. You can't stick something through the ear and like do a swipe. Like, that's not how that works. It's not like a cartoon, right? That's like what I picture in like a neuroscience cartoon. They're just like,
yeah.
But so I think it's really cool. You guys are trying to apply, you know, EEG, something more close to the brain, like an electric measure. Cause I mean, in animal studies, we use like electrophysiology a lot. It's still in brain slice. So how different is that in like human versus like animal EFIS?
Well, the difference is that it's indirect. So we basically, you might know this, I'm sure you know this term, neurons that fire together, wire together, right? Yeah. That's how neuroplasticity is often summarized in this catchy little term. Actually, it's neurons that fire in so that one neuron is firing right before the other one fire together, but that's not as catchy. anyway, we basically have two methods. One is in the auditory regions and one is in the motor cortex, in which we artificially make neurons fire together and then we measure how well they wire together. If people want to look it up, the motor cortex one is called paired associative stimulation and it's done with TMS. And then the other one is called sensory-induced long-term potentiation, which is a big mouthful and done with EEG. And it can be done either in the visual domain or the auditory domain. We're doing it on the auditory domain. And there are some other labs that are also using this in connection to psychedelics. And it will be really cool to look at that data in about 5 years. There's some people doing it with depressed patients, some people doing it with eating disorder patients. We're doing it with different age groups of healthy people, and it will be really interesting to compare notes.
Yeah.
But yeah, so the difference is that it's indirect. You know, you're not directly stimulating a brain slice. With EEG, of course, you've got all the artifacts from muscles, and you've got the fact that the signal is coming through the scalp, and you're only measuring a certain subpopulation of neurons that's oriented in a certain way, and you can only measure the cortex and so forth. It works, but it's indirect.
Yeah. Just something to think about. It's still insanely awesome. And I want to go from the preclinical and learn some of the more clinical. EEG is fascinating to me. So
yeah, it's pretty cool.
So back on the plasticity chat, we always, you know, focus on plasticity induced by psychedelics as something that's positive, right? You talked about how it's so helpful with like learning and in adaptations that you have throughout life. And with psychedelics, it was shown in a couple of different studies that the hypothesis is that the plasticity is what's leading these positive effects in depressed patients, mm-hmm. right? So do you think that there could be instances where increased plasticity is potentially harmful in individuals?
Sure. I mean, especially if you step back from psychedelics for a second, I'll come back to them. But there are clearly places where drug-induced neuroplasticity is not good. If we both took a big hit of cocaine right now, it would also enhance neuroplasticity in certain brain regions. So location is key, location, location. Cocaine enhances neuroplasticity in the mesolimbic circuit, which is part of the brain that is, it's a reward center, but it's also responsible for addiction and responsible for people really connecting cocaine and other addictive drugs with pleasure very quickly. So that's not good, right? You don't want neuroplasticity there. Psychedelics seem to not so much affect that region. They seem to enhance neuroplasticity in the cortex. It's a little bit hard to say. I can definitely think of a potential example where that might not be good. In certain brain regions, you would hopefully expect it to be mostly good. Like if neurons in the prefrontal cortex grow, right? The prefrontal cortex is responsible, among other things, for emotional regulation. You would suspect that more neuron growth in that area is a good thing. I'm not convinced it always is, but I think it probably tends to be a good thing. The one example where I think there's a real potential for it not to be good is HPPD. HPPD stands for hallucinogen persisting perceptual disorder. It has an entry in the DSM-5, which is the clinical Bible of clinical disorders, psychological disorders. But to be honest, I'm not sure anybody quite knows exactly what HPPD is. The main symptoms are perceptual changes, especially things like visual snow, floaters, color changes, stuff like that, seeming to have been triggered after a hallucinogen experience or potentially also other drugs. So some dopaminergic drugs seem to be able to trigger it as well. Mm-hmm. And I think it's possible that that's some kind of maladaptive neuroplastic change in the visual domain. And there was some recent work coming out, I think of Robin Carhart-Harris's lab. It's a preprint still, so it hasn't been peer-reviewed, but they were assessing HPPD and trying to find some risk factors for it. One of the biggest risk factors was young age. Mm-hmm. So younger and also therefore more plastic brains were more susceptible to HPPD. I'm not sure if that's a direct effect or not. They didn't say. It could be that young people also take more stupid risks with psychedelics and that explains it, because also polydrug use was a risk factor. But it could really be that younger brains are more susceptible to HPPD. And I know here in Switzerland, people are extremely cautious about giving psychedelics, either clinically or in a study, to people who are under 21, if not under 25. And that's not necessarily because of HPPD, that has other reasons as well, but there's reason to be cautious there with extremely young brains.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point. I've actually never sat down and just like thought about it for a second, but yeah, like a lot of like teenagers, right? I mean, in America especially, like we'll just take mushrooms recreationally or, you know, drop acid at a music festival, what have you. And I've never thought about the fact that like you're 17 to what, 20, 21, and you're just doing these for fun, like, which fine, you know, but I've never thought about the fact that the brain is still more plastic technically than when you're an adult. And so having that and increasing those connections might disrupt in a potentially not beneficial way.
Yeah. And it seems to also depend a bit on what the psychedelic experience was like, because it's important to remember with neuroplasticity, as I said at the beginning, it's experience dependent. The changes that take place in a more plastic brain depend on the experience. Mm-hmm. So that's why, there's a bit of a debate about whether therapeutic effects from psychedelics are neuroplasticity or the experience. If it's neuroplasticity, it's also the experience. It's experience dependent. And one paper on HPPD, I think it's from 2018 from Halpern and colleagues, they interviewed some people who had HPPD. Not very many, unfortunately, but what they saw was that almost all of them felt that their HPPD was triggered after a frightening psychedelic experience, not a good one. Hmm. And so the author of that paper wondered if maybe HPPD is some kind of trauma-like disorder that's triggered by a frightening experience. Maybe the brain adapts differently to that. And a lot of people with HPPD also have extra symptoms that are not perceptual, like derealization, dissociative symptoms, or anxiety or something like that, which would hint at some kind of traumatic reaction to a bad trip.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah, I'm excited to see more work get done on HPPD, because it wasn't even talked about very much until the last few years. So
Yeah, and the problem is it's also quite rare. It seems to be quite rare, especially when we distinguish it from just normal flashbacks, which are apparently not that rare. Mild flashbacks happen in about 7% of healthy people who take LSD or psilocybin.
I did not know that. Wow.
Yeah, this is data from a lab in Basel run by Matthias Lichti. I think they published a couple of papers detailing this. One is called Safety Pharmacology of LSD in Healthy Subjects or something to that effect. And then they've actually published a paper specifically about flashbacks this or last year, where they just reiterated this data point. About 7% have mild flashbacks. And when I say mild, I mean mild. It's like they're looking at a white wall and they see some like little blooping colors for a second, that kind of mild, mm-hmm. So not really a problem. And I think it's also important when working with psychedelics to make sure people know that's not a big deal, because you don't want them to panic. But HPPD is different. HPPD is actually debilitating, and that is a lot rarer, thank goodness, but we need to better understand what exactly is going on there.
Yeah, I think there's a study, maybe it's Hopkins, they're like doing a survey collection right now.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah. And there's also the Perception Restoration Foundation, which is run by, I believe, someone who has HPPD, who's advocating for more research into this as well.
Cool.
Yeah.
Awesome. This is a great segue to get into what you guys are currently recruiting for, right? Your longitudinal study. Do you want to talk a little bit about it, like the reasoning for what you guys are
absolutely looking for? Yeah, this is the reason for me doing podcasts, shamelessly plug this study, and also because podcasts are fun. But yeah, so we have, as a side quest for my PhD, I've started to get a little bit interested in negative effects of psychedelics, and the reason for that is I think we can have the illusion of having information about the negative effects of psychedelics when we don't really have very much information on them at all. Sometimes people even give you a tiny bit of pushback for studying negative effects. The reasoning being, you know what? We've had the war on drugs for so long. There's been this over-focus on negative effects, and it was disproportionate and undeserved. And now we need to focus on the positive. And so that makes people feel like we already know a lot about the negative effects, right? But actually we don't. Because all of that supposed information from that era, a lot of it was just misinformation, stuff like LSD stays in your spine and triggers flashbacks 10 years later while you're driving and then you die,
Yeah, like all of it's like made up to like scare people into not.
Exactly. Or if you take LSD 7 times, you're legally insane, stuff like that. So there was this overfocus on the negative, sure, but there was very little real information. And so I noticed that we just don't have a lot of real information about the negative effects, and I wanted to collect some because scientists like to go collect data on the stuff we don't know anything about. Mm-hmm. And so we're doing this in the LSD study in person in FRIWO. So we have a big list of, we call them side effects. It's hard to know what to call them. and we ask people which of these they've experienced. And we something that we do in our trial that not a lot of trials do, or maybe this is slowly changing, is we explicitly ask people about everything on our list. We don't wait for people to spontaneously report side effects. We specifically ask. And that gives you, I think, a better idea of what side effects people are actually experiencing. And then for this online study, we are looking for people who are planning on taking psychedelics soon in the next 3 months or so. And we would ask people to fill out a questionnaire before they take psychedelics and a couple of different times after they take psychedelics. And let me just tell you what I really like about this study. So we call this study the ambivalent effects of psychedelic study because we didn't really want to call it the side effects study, and we didn't want to call it the negative effects study. And the reason for that is, first of all, with psychedelics, it's not clear what is a side effect and what is not. Right. You know, what is the main effect? Side effects is something that people roughly understand. You know, they know that it's stuff like headaches and vomiting and probably not the mystical experience. That's probably not a side effect. That's kind of the point. But still, that was a term we just didn't want to use. And then we didn't want to call them negative effects either, because not all of them are negative for everybody. So the types of things we're assessing are, first of all, physical effects, things like headache, vomiting, fast heart rate, dry mouth, that sort of thing. And also psychological stuff like anxiety or derealization, or also HPPD-like symptoms are in there. So perceptual effects, and a few other things as well. And we call them ambivalent effects because in the study, we are actually not just assuming that they're going to be negative. We are asking people in the study, first of all, have you experienced this thing? Like, let's take vomiting, because it's a classic example with ayahuasca, right? People vomit on ayahuasca and it feels like a purge and it feels great. And then you probably also do have some people who vomit and hate it just like normal. I strongly suspect that is the case. But we'll ask people, you know, let's say someone took ayahuasca and then they're in the study. We'll ask them, did you experience vomiting? And if they say yes, we then ask, how did you feel about that? Was it positive or negative? And what, if any, impact did it have on your life afterward, positive, negative, or none? And then we also ask them, do you think that this side effect was related to the drug? And that is an important question for this longitudinal analysis that we're doing. So we ask people about side effects or ambivalent effects within the first couple of days after their trip, a week later, a month later, and 3 months later. Mm-hmm. Because especially for the psychological stuff, you do hear stories about people struggling with psychological symptoms after trips. And I would kind of like to know how common that is, as much as a study like this can even assess that. Yeah. And so it's really important to ask people this, you know, especially at the 3 month follow-up. Let's say someone says they're experiencing anxiety. It's important to ask, well, did they feel like it was related to the trip or not? Because for us, that's very hard to assess. and so we would like to know what they think. And we're also going to compare the side effects at that time point to the side effects or ambivalent effects that we took at baseline before the trip. And just so people don't get totally bummed out, there is some positive stuff in the study too. It's not just about ambivalent effects or side effects or whatever you want to call them. But the main focus is on trying to characterize side effects of psychedelics in the short and long term. So I really hope people who are maybe planning on doing psychedelics soon would consider participating, because it's not so easy to recruit for a study like this. And we do already have quite a few participants, but we also need more. Mm-hmm. So maybe there can be a link in the show notes to the study later for people who are interested.
Yeah, we can definitely do that. I know we have a decent amount of non-scientist, you know, listeners who do partake in psychedelics. So sure, everybody check out the show notes for the link to that.
And we're grateful for anybody who participates, and people can also email me with questions. I do all the tech support too.
I was going to ask you, so for this study, is it like very like multiple choice? Or is there like room for people to like fill out their experiences, or?
It's a lot of multiple choice questions, but people can add information later.
Cool.
So it was really important for us to be able to assess how people actually feel about these effects. You know, we don't just want to assume it's related to the trip or assume it's negative, or the other way around. We don't want to assume it's not related either. Mm-hmm. So we really want to hear from people about what their experience is. And so there's a lot of open questions that people can use to add more information.
Cool. And then I had another thought. that I lost, and it actually just came back. And I liked what you said about, you know, really trying to get at the longitudinal aspect of it and kind of figure out, okay, are these effects due to this experience? Are they just, you know, normal everyday up and down mood stuff? Because I feel like a lot of the psychedelic studies that we have right now are very focused on maybe, you know, a 1 week follow-up, a 3 month follow-up. And like the times that they're like asking about, I feel like misses things, because some people have reported that they feel great right after, you know, and even up to like, you know, a couple weeks, and then in between follow-ups, they might feel really down or, you know, something like that.
Yeah, and especially with treatment-resistant depression, you know, someone's had depression for 20 years and you're going to do a 1 week follow-up, that's nothing.
Yeah.
Plus, in pretty much any study of psychological problems, you have other issues like regression to the mean. Mm-hmm. You know, people seek treatment, they sign up for a study when they're doing really bad, and just through the natural course of things, they get a bit better without any treatment at all. That's part of the placebo effect. Mm-hmm. So you have that in there too. I mean, I'm not saying all these studies are BS, but it's, you know, these big effect sizes that you see in the early trials get smaller in phase two and even smaller in phase three. And that's going to happen with psychedelics as well. It always happens.
Yeah. And it's with anything, not even just with psychedelics.
Yeah, for sure.
Any
for
sure. treatment, novel treatment that you're looking at, there's always going to be the heightened response. And then as it goes on, you'll see more specifics, more nuance. And that's what science is about. So.
Yeah.
So you gave some like a good example of, you know, the vomiting. It could be positive for some, negative for others. Do you think there's any just truly ambivalent psychedelic effects? And sometimes maybe we just use the terms positive or negative because we don't know what to call them.
Yeah, absolutely. That's certainly true of acute effects. We measure acute effects in the LSD study with healthy people. And we ask people once an hour how they're doing, especially if they've been very quiet. I think it's important to just check in. And we always ask them, how strong are the good LSD effects right now? And how strong are the bad LSD effects right now? Because it's an easy way for us to assess about where they are. And sometimes we'll ask like, how strong are the LSD effects overall right now? And they'll say 100 out of 100. Okay, how strong are the positive effects? 100. Okay, how strong are the negative effects? Also 100. So you really get this ambivalence, this kind of paradoxical ambivalence with psychedelics. And sometimes people can also be really high on that negative effect scale and also just kind of not care, like they're equanimous or whatever the word is. But even after that, people can have ambivalent feelings about things they experience after the trip as well. You really see that when you work with psychedelics. And I think you would also see it in a questionnaire like this. People are also allowed to say on the questionnaire that it's both. You know, like maybe, for example, someone feels anxiety after their trip to take that again. And it could be that the trip brought something up for them that they are glad to work through, but it's also not pleasant right now. And so that would be perhaps truly ambivalent.
I think that's a good point of like, not everything that comes out of these trips is rainbows and sunshine. Mm-hmm. Like actually, even with healthy participants, right? Like,
yeah.
And I think that's what I always try to stress when people ask me about what I do and like about, you know, do you have any like harm reduction tips for like psychedelic users? And I'm always like, you never know what's going to happen. So like, just be prepared to be unprepared, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. You really never know. I mean, almost nobody gets what they expect. It's crazy.
Do you think that assigning negative versus positive to different like reactions or different symptoms or whatever alters people's perception? Is that part of the reason why you guys are sticking with ambivalent?
Mm-hmm. Definitely. So this is definitely true during the acute experience. Even asking someone to judge it at all does very clearly change the way they experience that. And people also tell us this afterward, you know. Sometimes that tends to be a bit of a less pleasant rather than more pleasant. You know, if you ask somebody to judge the experience, they were just kind of going with the flow before, then it introduces judgment into the experience. And maybe it's, you know, for that moment with this stupid scientist asking her stupid questions, it's maybe less fun. But even afterward, I think so. I mean, there probably is such a thing as overthinking reactions to psychedelics. And I mean, also in meditation, there's a reason that they emphasize non-judgment. As soon as you start to judge something, there's a potential to suffer from it. Mm-hmm. But the reason we wanted to assess how people feel about it is it's kind of a proxy for severity. And we definitely want to know how it affects their lives. You know, let's say people are feeling, maybe they feel a bit anxious, but they don't feel like this is affecting their life that much, then it's maybe not so severe. Or they could feel really anxious in a way that's debilitating and they have to go to therapy for it. And that's a very different thing.
Yeah, for sure. Do you think that, so you work with LSD mainly, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Do you think that there are certain psychedelics that would be more prone to like a negative versus positive versus neutral, or like, do you think it's more dependent maybe on the person or how the psychedelic is used, like recreational or spiritual or for mental health or in a clinic or loaded?
Yeah, I'm pretty agnostic about that. Although I'm interested to see what the side effect study reveals. I'm definitely going to test for differences between drugs. We have 8 drugs in the study. I think probably most of the variance doesn't come from the specific drug, but rather from how it's used, at least for the serotonergic psychedelics, the classic psychedelics. Some people think MDMA is more prone to positive mood effects. To be honest, I'm not 100% convinced of that. I think people can have very difficult trips on MDMA as well. But yeah, I would say I'm agnostic and I'm interested to see the data there.
Yeah, great answer. Very simple. Whatever my PI, we do like some like lectures sometimes to undergrads, or like he'll do just like smaller lectures to students. And a lot of times they'll like ask him like, do you think psilocybin could like heal this? Or do you think like this could do that? And he always says, we'll have to see the data. It's like,
always. Yeah, it's so true. I know. It's true. There's a lot we don't know. So much low hanging fruit. It's like, we'll never be out of a job in this field.
No, seriously. When I started my PhD, like I do like mouse work. So we do a lot of head twitch response. Mm-hmm. And I was astonished. It was like my first start of my project. And I was like, no one's looked at sex differences in head twitch. No one's done that. Like no one's just done a study. Like it's like the smallest berry that you just pick. Like,
yeah. Crazy. Also in our study, we're looking at that via hormone levels. Because in blood platelets, estradiol changes how LSD binds to the serotonin 2A receptor. So it's not crazy to think that that might have some effect on the subjective experience. You don't see global differences between men and women generally, but maybe it depends on the cycle. So that's something we're looking at too. And it's also very low hanging fruit, you know, just really basic stuff. Yeah. By the way, you mentioned head twitch. What does that look like? Like, do they look like they're nodding or shaking their head, or what is it? What does it look like to you?
It's so funny to like explain it. We're on video, so I'm just going to show you. It's like, so for the listeners, I can't show you, but you'll just have to imagine with us, but it's essentially, they like have like their ears and their little tags in their ears. That is how we pick it up, because we do it automated. So the ear tags help us see kind of like the shake, because it moves, but essentially they just go like this.
Like a circular movement.
It's like a little bi-directional, like circular, like it kind of looks like they have like something on their face and they're like, get away from me, you know.
It almost looks like a dance move when you do it.
Yeah. Maybe I will upload just this part of the video, because that's pretty funny. But yeah, so it's, once you like watch it a couple times, it's pretty easy to recognize. I just published an episode with it, talking to the person who automated it.
Yeah, that'll be interesting to listen to. It's so cool to talk to animal researchers, because there's just some stuff that I kind of miss working with humans, because I used to work in a mouse lab too with THC. And so it's kind of cool to see what you guys are up to.
Yeah.
And I can also halfway understand it most of the time.
That's good, right? Because I feel like that's a lot of issue within like the clinical side and the preclinical side. There's not a lot of people that overlap. And I think that's a huge issue in psychedelic science specifically, because that's why we have the two camps of like the 2A, not the 2A, the trip, not the trip. It's like, can we just all work together?
And it's probably 2A and track B. I mean, why not? Why wouldn't it be both? And it's probably the trip and plasticity, if plasticity can be confirmed in humans. Why not both?
Like that's what I always say. I'm like, I'm pretty sure it's both. I don't think it's one. Yeah. We don't live in a box.
Like, yeah. And, you know, options are great, right? If we have some antidepressants that work tolerably well without the trip, great.
Yeah.
People who have depression and schizophrenia and their family can have those. That would be amazing.
Exactly. That's what
I will probably also be useful for some people too.
Right. And I think everyone should just have a choice. Like everyone should have the choice to do the treatment the way that they want to without going to jail. That's all I say.
Yeah. There we go. That would be great.
So honestly, that's a great point to the question I wanted to ask you. So you're in Switzerland and you've been in Europe most of your life, mm-hmm. right? All of your life, pretty much.
Adult life.
Adult life.
I moved here when I was 19.
Okay. So in Switzerland, there's a huge, rich history of psychedelics. That's a little different than the US. And you guys mm-hmm. over there have been doing psychedelic assisted therapy, right? Like just
yeah, well, not me because I'm not a therapist,
not you,
but in our clinic. Switzerland. Switzerland has had psychedelic assisted therapy on and off since 1988 or so, above ground, in clinical trials and also in compassionate use, or technically it's called exceptional medical use. Okay. Is the paradigm here. And today there's about 40 or so psychiatrists who practice exceptional medical use with psychedelics in treatment resistant patients.
Okay. So do you think that the way that Switzerland has been doing this for years kind of promotes safer use or like less negative effects than kind of what we're seeing in the US in these like clinical trials and how it's still technically underground and
Well, I can't really judge what's going on in the US because I don't have so much contact to the mm-hmm. US, to be honest. There are some things about Switzerland that might make it safer than it otherwise would be. I think one of the biggest strengths in Switzerland is community and networks between therapists. Basically, they all know each other. Switzerland is not a very big country, so this works here. You have peers that you can discuss things with all the time. They check and balance each other. You can pool experience. And I think that probably does make the patient experience a lot better. Everyone learns from each other. People are not going off and lone wolfing on their own, because that's when people start to run into problems, is when they go off on their own and develop grandiose ideas about how great of a therapist they are and turn into a guru and start a cult. And this actually happened. I'm not making that up.
Well, that's just, you know, being in the US, I can speak to a little bit about like what I've heard and listened to and talked to people about, but like, because it's like illegal here and because there's no like exceptional use or anything, you know, it's all been underground for so long that there's, you know, people who develop these grandiose ideas and try to, you know, do like, for example, like sex therapy with psychedelics, and they give people psychedelics and then like assault them. Like it's Jesus. Reported. Like that's like an extreme example, obviously. But then you just have, you know, the clinical trials, which, you know, are regulated, but there are some people that so the MAPS model, and I think some other people have adopted the MAPS model, which essentially you have one person who's a licensed therapist and you have someone who's unlicensed in there mm-hmm. in the room, and they're supposed to be recording everything, but like there are some issues with compliance and watching the videos, as I'm sure you've seen online. Mm-hmm. But so just like the issues with that and who's like doing it and who's performing therapy and having someone unlicensed is like kind of weird to me, but
yeah, because it's a check and balance on them, right? Like this is maybe another difference to Switzerland, where you have to be a licensed psychiatrist with extra psychotherapy training in order to request an exemption for psychedelics. And just so people know which drugs we're talking about, it's LSD, MDMA, and psilocybin.
Okay.
And some of them work together with clinical psychologists. You know, it's also great to have those on the team, but you don't have unlicensed people practicing above ground. That means if a patient really has a problem with something you do, there's someone they can call. There's at least some potential for accountability. I certainly haven't heard of any cases of patient abuse in above ground therapy here.
Yeah.
Knock on wood that they don't really exist.
Yeah, I really wanted to, you know, see if you had any thoughts of just about like being closer to like a legal model where there is checks and balances more so
it's,
than
it's wonderful. And frankly, I think it would be very difficult to work with LSD in the way that I do without that. You know, we have above ground psychedelic elders here. We have people who have been doing this for decades, and who have a lot of experience to share and who are very willing to share it. And it's easy to meet them. And I, of course, in the clinic I work in, my doctoral supervisor does compassion or exceptional medical use with LSD, psilocybin, and MDMA. And so you're very close to people who you can discuss things with and learn from. And that's really, really cool. I'm not sure what it's like in the US, what situations people tend to be in. I'm sure it's very different, but it's very cool to have that here.
Yeah, it was hard for me to kind of like get into, like break into the field. Because where I went to undergrad, like nobody did the research except for the one person that came in like my senior year and I like jumped into their lab. But yeah, so when I was in college, undergrad, nobody talked about it. People thought I was a drug addict when I brought it up.
Wow.
And I would like go to like some events, or I volunteered with MAPS back in the day and like had like a psychedelic dinner, and I like put it online and was like, everybody come fundraise, like I want to meet people who are interested in this research. So flying here, I met a bunch of people through that, which was really cool, and then kind of built up and went to like symposiums and heard people talk about stuff, but it was like a long time. It wasn't like you just call up your friends or your boss and they know somebody. It's like that now, but that's after How to Change Your Mind, after MAPS phase two trot, like, you know.
I was quite afraid of this actually when I was deciding for sure to do a PhD in this field. I kind of thought, oh, other scientists are not going to take it seriously. I'm going to feel like a weirdo, or they're going to think I'm a drug addict and stuff like that. I was really aware of these stereotypes, and ultimately I knew, you know, this topic had hooked me for whatever reason, and I really wanted to study it, and I decided to do it. But I was worried about that, and I would not have predicted the explosion in interest, also from the general public. Like, my mom heard about psilocybin on the news.
Yeah,
that was almost unthinkable 5 years ago.
Yeah, I remember when I told my mom my like hopes and dreams, right? And she was like, "But what?" She like nobody understood. And I remember I sat at the like on the couch with her and like explained it all to her for like an hour. And then now I have, you know, my partner's parents texting me, "Have you watched How to Change Your Mind? That was so cool." Like, you know, it's like funny. Just how it, but yeah. All right. So my final question for you is, what do you think that the psychedelic field as a whole could approve upon when it comes to understanding these compounds, these serotonergic psychedelics?
Well, I think for understanding, you need humility, especially in such a young field. You know, if there's any group of people that should be really good at relaxing its beliefs and updating them, it should really be people who study psychedelics, right? I think it's important to keep in mind what's just a theory and what's a fact. Like, neuroplasticity is just a theory. It often gets kind of touted almost as fact, especially by the media and stuff. But yeah, just humility, willingness to recognize that we don't necessarily know everything it seems like we know about psychedelics. The question of clinical efficacy is still a little bit up in the air. You know, that's kind of the big focus of this field right now. I really wonder if it's going to stay the focus of this field, because I really feel like we don't know what the phase three trials and the long-term follow-ups are really going to look like. Mm-hmm. It's very clear to me that sometimes psychedelics are really helpful for people's mental health, but that's not really the research question of the clinical trials. But that research question is, are these helpful enough in a safe enough way, reliably enough, that a doctor should feel comfortable prescribing them to his average depressed patient? And if not, who exactly is it helpful for? Those are still some big open questions. And I think we just need some humility and willingness to occasionally update our beliefs about psychedelics and what the hell they are doing.
Yeah, definitely. And I think an important add-on to that, like that kind of goes back to just the beginning and talking to you, is taking a step back and just going for the basic questions that are still unanswered, I think is super important, just to have an overall understanding of what they can do, of how they're beneficial, how they're not beneficial, you know, so.
Yeah, and a better understanding of how to prevent really adverse experiences, which is ties into this negative effects study a little bit, and also how to help people who are experiencing those, because it does happen. And you don't want people to feel totally lost when they go through that.
Well, thank you so much, Abigail, for your time. It was great to finally meet and connect with you and talk with you. And we're always thrilled to have these conversations and bring them to our listeners on Your Brain on Science.
Yeah, thank you. This was fun.
So for those tuning in today, remember that we're going to link the study in the show notes, and we'll post it on our Twitter, in our Instagram, and remember to share this episode with your friends and family if you liked it. Like our content, check out our website for more information and more content. It's psychedelicbrainscience.com.